Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. Today we're going to hear part of my conversation with Professor John Pfaff. John Pfaff is a professor at Fordham Law School, and he is the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. Give me a summary. What's your book about? Tell us about your book, sir.
Yeah. So I mean, the main argument I'm trying to make is that this conventional wisdom we have, the things it points to matter, they're not irrelevant. But there's other things that matter more. And importantly, by focusing on things we do focus on, we tend to miss the things that matter more and arguably make it even harder sometimes to address the things that matter more. And so, you know, drugs is a great example of that. You know, personally, I think, you know, prison is a terrible way to handle drugs. I think most public health people think that prison is a terrible place to manage drug addiction. Even drug courts are tricky and problematic. And the more we can move into a public health view of drugs, the better. But the catch is that, you know, in the state prison system, and the states hold about 90% of all prisoners, they do most of the work, only about 15%, 1-5, not 5-0, of the people in prison are in prison for drugs, at most. It's probably, in reality, it's probably even less than that, because we classify people in prison by the most serious charge for which they were convicted. And so if someone is arrested for, say, you know, aggravated assault as part of a domestic abuse situation and he has cocaine on him at the time of the arrest, perhaps the abused partner won't testify. It's a murky situation. And so the DA will agree to a deal. If you plead guilty to the cocaine, we'll drop the aggravated assault. He agrees, but the DA says, but we're going to demand prison time for the cocaine because of that assault. Right, that person shows up in our data as a nonviolent drug offender because from a prison point of view, the aggravated assault played no role. And so he's really there for violence, but shows up in our data as there for drugs. Right, and so our 15% include the true drug cases and these sort of pretextual drug cases. We can't break it apart. And, you know, about 55% of all people are in prison for violence. And of the long-serving inmates, those in the top 10% of the time served in a given state prison, almost all of them, well over 95% of them, are in for either murder, manslaughter, rape, or robbery. Probably as you spend more and more time, it becomes more than half of those who are in for a really long time are in for homicide. And so on the one hand, the 200 and some, the like 190,000 people who are in prison for drugs, you know, even if you're not an abolitionist, a large number of them should not be in prison. And so pushing back against incarceration as a way to respond to drug issues is good policy. But we have to do that in a way that doesn't preclude our ability to later take on the issue of violence. And we tend to do that. Right? Just before my book came out, right, when my editors would not let me change it and throw off all their page work and all the editing they've done, so it's not in there, Vox came out with this survey of about 3,000 people nationwide asking them questions about criminal justice reform. And there are two questions that are very closely linked and very problematic. One question was, do you think a majority of people are roughly a majority of people are in prison for drugs? And the survey broke things out by liberal, moderate, and conservative. And a majority of all three groups said yes, that about half of all people are there for drugs. But it's not 50%, it's 15%, right? It's completely wrong. That's bad. But the next question is what makes that question answer so problematic. Because the next question, well, one next question was, are you in favor of reducing the time spent in prison by those convicted of violence who pose little to no risk of reoffending? And for there, a majority of all three groups from 55% of liberals to 65% of conservatives said no, that they are not in favor of changing how we punish violence, right? And so the problem I think we've done is that we've put drug cases so much at the center of our discussion of prisons that we think we can get out of prisons, we can decarcerate in a meaningful kind of way just by focusing on the easy drug cases, and it means we remain unwilling to go after the harder violence cases. That oftentimes we phrase it as a trade-off, right? We're going to cut back on drugs in order to focus on violence and save prison beds for people who commit crimes of violence. That we, in fact, sometimes will actually, in the legislative process, you see this trade-off where the compromise is you cut the drug sentences in exchange for ratcheting up the sentences for violent crimes, right? And so the point I'm trying to make isn't so much that drugs are irrelevant. There are 200,000 people in state prisons, another 90,000 in federal prisons for drugs. That's 300,000 people, most of whom probably pose no safety risk in any meaningful kind of way, or to the extent they do pose a safety risk, something much more public health, housing, food-centered would be a far more effective and humane way of addressing that. But we've framed the debate in such a way that we make it really hard to ask these much more unavoidable, intractable problems about violence.
Indeed, in the drug policy reform, I know that we got much better over the last few decades. But back in the 80s and into the 90s, marijuana legalizers like myself talked about how this would allow authorities to focus on harder drugs, and that was stupid. I mean that was just stupid. It was wrong. And we've learned since then, and we've changed that to, but then again, we've also, as you were saying, we talk about the need then to focus on more serious crime and violent crimes. And that leads to another problem, which, of course, we have a lot of, the Innocence Project and a lot of the state groups have shown there are a lot of people who are in for crimes they didn't actually commit. And then you've got the clearance numbers in general. Even with that, we only get about 50% of the violent crimes cleared each year. Of course, those. Well, I want to ask you about I want to ask you about the numbers before we go into some of the other stuff. I've always believed you need to have good data if you're going to formulate good policies. You may not formulate good policies even if you have the good data, but if you don't have the good data, it's going to be really hard. But criminal justice data, it's not what people think. It's not as cut and dry as people think.
Yeah. So before I get to the data, actually, I want to go back to, I think, a point you kind of raised in passing, I think is important to mention to people. So you talk about these Innocence Project findings, and they're real and they're significant. But the catch is also is that by and large, they're limited to death penalty cases, some rape cases, but mostly death penalty, because those are the cases, A, where the person's been in prison long enough for these cases to work their way through the system. They also, the reason why it's murder and rape, is that the cases where most likely they have DNA evidence, which is what we use for exoneration. I'm not sure it's safe to extrapolate from capital cases to all of the crimes. In both directions, it's confusing, right? On the one hand, in capital cases, prosecutors face the most amount of pressure to get a conviction, right? These are front page news killings. If this case gets botched, it's going to cost the current elected DA perhaps his job. If the assistant district attorney does a great job, this is his ticket to either better private practice or perhaps being the elected DA himself or a federal prosecutor position, right? And so the incentives to overwhelm things are greater there. On the other hand, capital cases are the cases where the defendant is most likely to have the highest quality lawyering he can get, right? And so the effects kind of offset, as opposed to a misdemeanor court where things kind of get ground through in really complicated ways and the law is really unclear. On the one hand, how in misdemeanor court do you even know if you broke the law? One of the big misdemeanor charges like in New York State is disorderly conduct. And disorderly conduct in New York State is with the intent to cause a nuisance, you play music too loud. Like, how do you even know when you violate that? Like, how do you even know what's innocent or guilty in that situation? But I think the bigger point I want to stress is that my guess is that almost everyone in the system is actually legally guilty, and I'm using that phrase very carefully, our criminal laws are incredibly broadly written, right? And you hear people talk a lot about sort of this over-criminalization problem, right? There's this funny, you know, Twitter feed called Crime A Day, which goes through the federal code, and every day tweets out one federal crime, like it's a federal crime. If you know, label pasta more than 5 millimeters thick as spaghetti, like that's a federal crime. And you know, it's ridiculous, but no one's in prison for federal pasta labeling, right? It's the real challenge we have is that, you know, our assault laws are broadly written, our public nuisance laws are broadly written, you know, our theft laws are broadly written, and so there are a lot. It's very easy to violate criminal conduct, even perhaps if punishment is not the right way to handle it, right? You know, when you punch someone in the head in a bar because you're frustrated and you're drunk and you just lose control and you punch them, you don't break their jaw, but you punch them. That's assault. Might even be aggravated assault. Might be assault with a deadly weapon, given that we've written deadly weapon if you hit them with your beer glass, right? Does every one of those cases really need to result in an arrest? Does it really need to result in a conviction? Is this really, does the criminal justice system have to police every sort of social ill that happens every time it happens? Right? That's our default response these days, right? As well, just punish them. And so I think as much as I admire what the work that the Innocence Project has done, I get concerned when it turns our framing around to like we have a huge innocence problem in our criminal justice system, because that implies that the people who are factually guilty kind of deserve to be punished. And I would stress that there's plenty of factually criminal behavior that doesn't necessarily deserve a record. Right? You know, when I was in high school, I punched a friend of mine in the head in a church. Right, so there's a different judging going on that one. But, you know, did I deserve to, like, have a permanent criminal record from, like, two kids just throwing one punch at each other? I don't think either of us deserved that, and neither of us got that because there were no cops in our church, right? So the Innocence Project framing it does good work, but I think the real focus we have to have is that it's very easy to trip up and break the law. Do we always need to use the law just because you break it? Probably not. So I think that's one thing just keep in mind. Now to go back to the question you asked at the end, sir, what is the nature of our data? I mean, there's a couple of things realize about our criminal justice data. One is that it tends to be profoundly out of date, and that's just because we choose not to fund it. Right? You know, I watch with envy when labor economists each month wait for like last month's labor statistics to come out. Right? Meanwhile, my crime data for us comes out with a year lag. Prison data comes out with a 2-year lag, although some of us have a 3-year lag, to almost 2.5-year lag to them. Other data sets are good 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 years out of date. You know, the last year we have comparable spending data on prosecutors and public defender and sort of indigent defense offices is like 2005, right? It's almost 15 years old. And that's because we just don't pay for it, right? The Bureau of Labor Statistics has a budget that is more than 10 times the Bureau of Justice Statistics budget. And the BJS's budget, fully half of it goes to just running one data program, right? And so we've just chosen not to fund this. And as a result, we don't really know what's going on, right? And so lots of our numbers that we rely on are incredibly stale. On top of that, reporting is voluntary, right? So not everyone always reports data. And I think, you know, how we define things is incredibly important, right? We talk about violent crime going up or violent crime going down, right? Or property crime going up or property crime going down. And I think, you know, if people don't really read the really, really small print, you might not kind of realize, like, what is violent crime? It's not all violence. It's just four violent crimes. Murder, manslaughter, aggravated assault, rape, the definition which has changed in recent years, and robbery. That's it. So, like, simple assault doesn't show up as an official crime number. Right, and we track arrests for that, but not crimes, right? And you know, confusion can happen if we're not paying close attention to this, right? We make about 500,000 arrests for those serious violent crimes: murder, manslaughter, rape, aggravated assault, and robbery. We make about 1 million arrests for simple assault, the one we don't sort of track the offending levels for. And you hear people say things like, "We arrest more people for marijuana than for violent crimes." That's only true if you count those four major violent crimes. First, you make 500,000 arrests and about 500,000 marijuana arrests. If you count the 1 million simple assault arrests, we actually make more arrests for violent crime than for marijuana. Right? We might still make too many marijuana arrests, right? But we're still misframing the nature of discussion because the way we choose to define things is very, very ornery and particular.
This is an interview with Dr. John Pfaff. He is a professor at Fordham Law School. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Philip Atiba Goff, the president of the Center for Policing Equity and a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, said about Locked In, quote, "Locked In is a game changer for those who care about the crisis of mass incarceration. John F. Pfaff's virtuosic effort explodes what he calls the standard story, showing us that the morally satisfying answers to questions about mass incarceration are usually wrong, and that the solutions are almost always more banal, making them harder to accomplish." End quote. Now, let's get to that interview with Professor John Pfaff. Yeah, what are you up to now?
Yeah, so my next project isn't so much about the policy versus politics point I brought up, but I'm still thinking through that. It's actually, I'm trying to undertake a study to really get a sense of what is the full social cost of incarceration, right? Usually when we talk about the cost of prisons, we say, you know, we're spending about $50 billion a year in prison. We spend about $30 billion a year on jail. But those aren't really the right costs to think about, in part because they're not entirely costs, right? You know, about two-thirds of that spending on prisons, and I think even a greater fraction of the spending on jails, is wages, right? And wages aren't entirely costs. They're this strange Keynesian multiplier thing that I didn't do well enough in graduate school in economics to fully grasp, but right? They're not entirely costs. The real social costs of prison is the fact, you know, perhaps people go to prison, they come out, they earn less, right? That they're physically and sexually assaulted while they're in prison, that the risk of death from a drug overdose skyrockets upon release from prison. And that's true in the United States as much as it is in like Germany and Holland. Like, it's just a universal nature of prisons that drug overdose deaths go up significantly within the first several weeks on release in prison. Now, overall, one study in New York State suggested that in the short to medium term, 1 year in prison cut 2 years off your expected lifespan. You know, families are weakened and strained. There's shame and stigma. You know, there's health costs. Prisons are vectors of tuberculosis and STDs and HIV. You know, so what is sort of this total sort of human cost of punishment? And remarkably, despite the fact that from the 80s to today, we've made probably close to half a billion arrests and admitted about 20 million people to prison, though not all unique people. And despite this massive social experiment that we've engaged in sort of this mass punishment unseen anywhere in the world or unseen even in our own history, we've never bothered to actually figure out what the real costs of it are. And so my next goal is really to try to understand what are the actual, like, not financial costs, but the actual, like, human costs of what we're doing. And once you see those human costs, you know, I think it's going to put, you know, whatever punitive benefits prisons have and punishment has more broadly, right, we need to be able to put them in proper sort of context. I think this is the key contextual piece that we just don't have.
Fascinating. So just in looking, but primarily at the prisons, not because, I mean, obviously law enforcement would be an even, it's my harangue has been for the longest time that looking at the costs of enforcement on drug laws, there's research out of England showing that it took an average of about 2 hours of police time to take care of one simple possession arrest. So, you know, they just did the math and saw how many police hours were being spent just dealing with possession. Give me your opinion, please, because I think that's a reasonably strong argument. On the other hand, it runs into the you know, backfiring about I don't know. What do you think about that kind of argument?
Well, looking at sort of police allocation and the cost of that, I mean, I think that's a legitimate question, right? I oftentimes, if we're going to look at, you know, sort of, you know, we often hear about this idea of sort of high, you know, communities which have high rates of crime are still, you know, sort of especially communities, poor communities of color are over-policed. And my perspective on that is better to think of it as mispoliced, right? That the police spend too much of their time focusing on low-level stuff while our homicide clearance rate is abysmal, right, for the offense, right? You know, this is actually a point that Jill Iovine makes in her great book, Ghettocide. She points out that the clearance rate for homicides in L.A. County as a whole, she's an L.A. Times reporter, who's embedded with a homicide unit in the South Central part of Los Angeles for several years. And she points out, you know, the clearance rate, how many murders and homicides result in an arrest? And for LA County as a whole, it's about 60%, which is about the national average. About, you know, about 2/3 of all murders produce an arrest. About 1/3 of murders never see anyone arrested for them. But in LA County, if the victim was a black man, that clearance rate drops from 60% to 30%. Right? So 2/3 of all murders of a black man produce no arrest at all. Right? And her sense is that a lot of the antagonism, so a lot of the, not antagonism isn't the right word, but a lot of the frustration and hostility that South Central, African Americans in particular in South Central felt towards the police, a lot of it, not all of it, obviously there's lots of things going on, but one non-trivial part of it was their sense of, why are you making these drug arrests while, you know, my son's homicide goes unsolved, right? And if we could focus on those homicide offenses, that could actually have some real benefits, right? And so there's this gross misallocation of policing that takes place. And so I think, you know, focusing on sort of those costs is absolutely spot on as well. I would just say, you know, when I, in terms of my project, I'm focusing just on prisons, because the way I describe it to my students is, you know, the criminal justice system is kind of a giant burning sun of failure, right? And if you try to stare at the whole thing at once, you're going to go blind. And so you have to pick your one little sliver of it, put on, like, you know, your eclipse glasses and stare at that one little bit as best as you can, and trust that other people are going to study the other parts and try to fix the other parts. And if I were to try to measure the entire social cost of punishment, arrests, electronic monitoring, jail time, probation, parole, prisons, sex offense registries, all that, my grandchildren wouldn't live long enough, I think, to get it done. And so I've chosen to focus on the prison part just because that's the area I'm most familiar with. Also, like, I just, you if you don't limit your analysis, it becomes impossible. And that said, I think it is important. We talk a lot about mass incarceration, trying to change mass incarceration in this country. And as someone who studied prisons, you know, his whole life, I get that. But mass incarceration and mass punishment are two very different things. And what, you know, in many ways, while prison gets all the attention, it's very much just a tip of the iceberg, right? No, I think one thing that confuses people is the way you hear the statistic is that we have about 1.5 million people in prison and about 750,000 people in jail. And those are one-day counts. On December 31st, how many people do we have in these facilities? It's about 1.5 million, 750,000. But the catch is that jail, which is used primarily for pretrial detention, has massive turnover in a way that prisons that are used for felony convictions that generally have a sentence of a year or more are not. And so we have a prison population of about 1.5 million. We admit about 600,000 people to prison every year. On any given day, there are about 750,000 people in jail, but we make 10 million jail admissions annually. And one recent study suggests that about 5 million unique people make up those 10 million people each year, right? And so the actual impact of jail is far vaster than the impact of prison, because it impacts far more people. 10 times as many people get admitted to jail every year, unique people get admitted to jail every year than get admitted to prisons every year. You know, we make somewhere between 10 to 12 million arrests. And again, not all unique people, but a lot of them are, right? And as you work your way down the system, different things matter more, right? So, you know, we make about, you know, drug arrests are one of the larger drug arrest category. About slightly more than 10% of all arrests are for drugs, and a large fraction of those are for marijuana. But marijuana makes about 1% of all prison population, right? And so decriminalizing or legalizing marijuana will probably have next to no impact on prisons. But it can have a significant impact on arrests. It can have a bigger impact on jails. Like, each of these institutions impacts different communities and different offenses and different strategies in different kinds of ways. And so I've increasingly found myself using this term mass punishment to say, look, mass arrests, that doesn't inevitably lead to mass jail. And mass jail doesn't necessarily lead to mass incarceration. And even to the extent that they are connected to each other, they're sorting people and impacting communities and people in different kinds of ways, each of which demands its own type of attention. And so I'm focusing on prisons, and I want to make it very clear that my prison results won't say, tell us about the jail or the policing parts. Those are other aspects that demand their own separate analysis. And so I think a lot of it is about actually paying attention to these down ticket elections, right? You know, we've started to acknowledge the importance of the prosecutor. That's fantastic. But now we're starting to realize that, you know, if you just change the prosecutor, not the judges, that can be a problem. That's what's happening. You know, Krasner's finding that problem in Philadelphia, where a lot of the judges are resisting his changes. Chicago has tried to change its bail courts, and the judges are balking there. Also, it suggests that, you know, especially outside of cities, once you get into more rural America, you know, sheriff elections matter tremendous. So the sheriff, like the DA, is a county elected official. They run the jail. Outside of incorporated towns, they make all the arrests. And so in rural America, they are hugely powerful and sort of utterly unremovable absent election. There's actually one sheriff somewhere, I don't know where, he is actually currently under indictment for trying to hire a hitman to kill one of his own deputies who had whistleblown on him. He's also still the sheriff because there's no way to make him step down while he is investigated for attempting to murder one of his own deputies. There's another case in Alabama, which actually had this old ancient Great Depression era provision that would actually allow sheriffs to keep whatever money they had for jails and didn't spend. They could keep it for themselves. And there, these sheriffs are basically buying summer homes while feeding the people in their jails food that was able, like, not fit for human consumption, right? And so they had tremendous impact on day-to-day lives of people in their jails and their communities. And they, again, like prosecutors 10 years ago, they have generally flown beneath the radar and only now starting to get attention, right? And I think sort of trying to really mobilize people to understand, like, you get to make these choices, and these people have tremendous power over day-to-day lives and really get people to get energized about that. And I think there are a lot of groups that are really starting to take that seriously, and groups that are starting to work hard to mobilize communities to get more involved and take these elections a lot, you know, to actually get out the vote and make these elections count.
That was my interview with John Pfaff. Dr. Pfaff is a professor of law at Fordham Law School, and he is the author of Locked In: The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. For now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you have been listening to Prison Pipeline. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Many thanks to my guest, Professor John Pfaff. Big thank you to our engineer, and a heartfelt thanks to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long.
Some simple thing that I've done. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.